The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Joanna Demers is Associate Professor of Musicology at the University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music, where she specializes in post-1945 popular and art music. Her book with Zero Books, Drone and Apocalypse, was published on December 11th in 2015. This week, she returns to the podcast to discuss drone music more generally. It's Wednesday, April 20th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to thank the people who reached out to me in the last week or so. Many people left compliments about last week's podcast with Fiona Singh, and I think this week's podcast about drone music works well as a follow-up. Again, we return to discussing aesthetics, perhaps from a formal perspective. In this episode, you'll hear a clip from the old BBC documentary about Musique Concrète, an original work of drone music created in Audacity by combining imported digital noise from the application Adobe and combining that with a stretched version of the national anthem, an excerpt from John Cage's album Indeterminacy, and the dronification of Star Wars. Right now you're listening to Negative Land's Yellow, Black, and Rectangular as Stretched. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing Joanna Demers and I discuss Basic Drone. Joanna Demers is Associate Professor of Musicology at the University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music, where she specializes in post-1945 popular and art music. She is also the author of the experimental novel Drone and Apocalypse, which came out from Zero Books in December of last year. And I'm glad to welcome her back to the podcast today to discuss drones and noise. Joanna, welcome to Zero Squared.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back.
Now, your book before Drone and Apocalypse, or one of them, was entitled Listening Through the Noise. And this is actually the only real question I have, so I'll start with it. The subtitle was The Aesthetics of Experimental Electronic Music. So what is the foundation of the aesthetics of this kind of music?
In a nutshell, it has to do with the affordances of phonographic technology. In the 20th century, we all of a sudden have the capacity to capture sound and to replicate it and to synthesize it. And this is a sea change for music of all sorts because it allows us to get out of the standard sorts of sounds that used to be coded as musical. So at the beginning of the 20th century, we were still in the West operating according to a system where in order to make music, you had to use instruments that were specified as musical instruments. And by the end of the 20th century, you can, with a perfectly straight face, get away with saying, I'm going to make music with anything, any instrument at all that produces sound. And it doesn't have to behave musically or consonantly or aesthetically. By the end of the 20th century, it's very common to have elements of noise and elements of the outside world in music. So that was really the instigation for talking about what sorts of things now count as music, specifically electronic music.
Musique Concrète is maybe the foundation for all of this kind of music then?
Sure.
The arrival of tape recorders meant even the most basic sounds could be transformed. Experimenting with music was no longer the monopoly of the imaginative musician. Even the earliest of tape recorders could manage quite happily the faithful reproduction of three notes twanged on the piano. It was the possibilities for unfaithful reproduction which also caused excitement. On this length of tape are those same three notes. If I wind this piece of tape through the machine by hand, at a speed which isn't constant and in a direction which is forever changing, those three twangs become a collection of quite different sounds. In fact, if we re-recorded this performance on another machine, I might end up with a sonata for three notes and tape recorder. And I wouldn't be the first. But let's take this creativity a stage further. Let's find the start of the last note. There it is. I'll cut the tape there. Now I can take the end note, turn it the other way round. Put it back, ready to join up. So, what have we got now? Our first two notes are still the right way round, producing a boing sound with a quick start and a slow finish, or what musicians call sharp attack, gentle decay. But now we've turned the last note the wrong way round. We've got the decay first. Now it's become a sound. And if I finish the joins here, it should sound something like this. Crude stuff, you're probably thinking. But to some people, the possibilities of doctoring natural sound using the new magnetic tape became an obsession.
It's not the only foundation, but it's a big one because it is the one that's predicated on capture of sounds. And capture of sounds that really no one thought was musical before. I mean, sounds of trains and sounds of factory machinery, these are really antithetical to what we thought music should have sounded like coming out of the Romantic era.
Yeah. Now it seemed to me that it comes along with other innovations, and maybe a little after, but other innovations in the arts. Where, for instance, you've got collage art, and you have cubism and Dadaism, which all of this was influenced by political events at the time and political ideology, but also influenced by the influx of world art. Tribal art, African art, non-Western traditions.
It's interesting. Most people, when they think of musique concrète, they think of it as being invented by a French composer named Pierre Schaeffer. And it's true, you know, in my book as well, I dwell extensively on him because he was a very prolific writer as well as composer. He wrote a lot about what he was doing. Mm-hmm. But this international quality to electronic music, I mean, you needn't look any further than the fact that really the very, very, very first composition of musique concrète was put together by an Egyptian composer named Halim El Gab, and it was put together in 1944. He had a situation that was very similar to Schaeffer's in that he was able to do what he did because he was working in a radio station, which at the time was the only place where folks had access to microphones and rudimentary recording equipment. It seems as if a lot of electronic music has connections either to post-colonialism or, you know, the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. And definitely the United States was actively and unapologetically supporting some of the composers associated with this movement in West Germany and West Europe in general, as a way of touting the aesthetic benefits of capitalism versus communism. Now, getting back to your great question, your larger question of how this relates to the arts as a whole, gosh, it just seems like the 20th century in so many arenas is the time when our focus expands, the screen widens across the arts, and we start to incorporate materials in different media that previously would not have been considered worthy of artwork. I mean, just the idea of collage. I mean, this is just something that wouldn't have happened really prior to the 20th century. And I'll probably get critiqued by an art historian, but my instinct is to say that this sort of expansion of the palette ran across disciplines.
Two reactions to this kind of music. On the one hand, I thoroughly enjoy it for the most part, uncritically. I think that I'm a science fiction fan and author, and so somehow this music speaks to that side of my personality. So I can take it in relatively easily, I've been prepared to listen to it by people like Delia Derbyshire, who did the theme for Doctor Who. But on the other hand, when I try to be intellectual about it, I'm not so sure I like everything about it. I've worked in the Oregon Symphony for 20 years and just in their ticket office. And so I went to a lot of classical concerts. I'm not any kind of expert in classical music. But what I experienced there was it's kind of the standard repertoire. You know, Beethoven's Ninth again, you know, every couple of years, or Stravinsky or Bach. At the same time that this was what was going on in the orchestra hall, the tradition of classical, European classical music had already been dashed by the time I got to, work at the symphony. I have friends who are music teachers, academics, who tell me that one of my friends tells me, John tells me that when he started teaching in the late 80s, it was already a time where everything was in disarray. People were abandoning the European classical music as quickly as they could, trying to find other ways and other projects, looking for grant money in different locations. And I wonder about that impulse to throw aside not just European classical music, but the notion that there is maybe advancements in understanding and excellence. Basically the dismantling of not just one set of standards, but the whole notion that there are standards. Am I overstating the case there? Or?
No. The funny thing about music, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that, and I'm talking about, kind of Western classical and academic music, is that we're a good 20 years behind the rest of the humanities and arts. So, the first musicologist to talk really with any sort of depth and authority about feminism did so starting in the mid-80s. I think we get to subjects late and we talk about them kind of slowly. So change is slow to occur. So, classical music has been dying for a long time. And also people have been talking about how new and innovative things like atonality and musique concrète and new complexity are. They've been talking about how new these things are for decades.
Right.
So, the whole problem is that kind of against anyone's expectations, in the middle of all of this, the pop industry got started around the mid-50s, and just all bets were off after that. And, pop artists start taking some of the technology or the approaches that might have been already present in experimental or avant-garde circles, and they ran with it, and they made things that, for my money, were much more interesting. Mm-hmm. And got lots and lots of people listening. And the rate of evolution in pop music has been, I think, much more rapid than in kind of the variants of the classical tradition. And I'm talking about like new music now, like that contemporary classical music. Even that hasn't changed as much as pop has in the past 30 years.
When the innovations move to the realm of popular music, do you see that as a less rigorous terrain, or as a terrain that's dictated more by market principles than the realm of, I guess, the academy and wherever art music is situated now in the nonprofit world?
Sure.
Are we losing something in terms of self-directed movement?
Mm-hmm.
What I think of as an avant-garde tradition, when we let the market and popular music take over innovation.
No, and I can give you an example. I mean, the Beach Boys start off doing quintessential California surf rock, and they make loads and loads of money doing this. And when Brian Wilson decides that he wants to work on the Pet Sounds project, they were already riding really high. And he didn't do Pet Sounds with any sort of market intervention. He just did it because he wanted to do it. And that album of any of the Beach Boys output is the one that has the most influence on folks across the board, from pop to experimental. Lots of university professors talk about how much they like Pet Sounds. You know, talking about pop, the pop industry is really tricky because it's a hydra, and it's not all homogeneous. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, there are very, very hit-oriented productions that are conceived solely for the point of making money. Yeah. And but even those aren't monolithic, in that someone who starts out in that vein could very easily go in a different direction. I mean, that one person that I admire in that capacity is Scott Walker, not the politician, mm-hmm. the musician who starts off very much in the kind of boy band, middle of the road, entertainment, pop music vein. And over the course of his career has become really squarely avant-gardist. So having one's roots in pop music, I don't think at all condemns you to be anti-critical, mm-hmm. or uninteresting.
It sounds like it's a terrain or an area where you have more freedom than if you're hemmed in by, I don't know, the academy, or by, again, the nonprofit world of orchestral music. I mean, there's nothing more conservative, I think, than the collection of folks who turn up for classical orchestral concerts.
I think it's hard for everybody. And you have to, you know, on a very personal, individual basis, you make concessions in terms of how you're going to, you know, live from day to day. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows that getting into academia or getting into the classical contemporary scene involves some trade-offs. And some people work very, very, very hard, and they're able to overcome those trade-offs and maintain some autonomy. But those are the lucky few, I think.
How do artists today view their predecessors? Like, for instance, is John Cage still well-loved?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Well, yeah. His centennial passed recently, and there are oodles of concerts around the world, and folks continue to... The publishing industry around John Cage is pretty healthy. I have a very close friend and colleague who does his best whenever he can to try to dismantle the Cage legacy publicly, mm-hmm. and not in any sort of abusive way, but just kind of point out, you know, Cage was openly hostile towards Black music. Cage was, in a lot of ways, continuing on work that other American experimentalist composers were already doing. Cage gets all of the glory, but very little of the blame, et cetera. So that, I think that's a very voluble topic right now.
Well, what I noticed about Cage, what I think about him, is that in some ways, he's like the worst New Ager I've ever run across.
This summer, I'm going to give a class in mushroom identification at the New School for Social Research. Actually, it's 5 field trips, not really a class at all. However, when I proposed it to Dean Clara Meyer, though she was delighted with the idea, she said, "I'll have to let you know later whether or not we'll give it." So she spoke to the president, who couldn't see why there should be a class in mushrooms at the new school. Next, she spoke to Professor McIver, who lives in Piermont. She said, "What do you think about our having a mushroom class at the new school?" He said, "Fine idea. Nothing more than mushroom identification develops the powers of observation." This remark was relayed both to the president and to me. It served to get the class into the catalog and to verbalize for me my present attitude toward music. It isn't useful, music isn't, unless it develops our powers of audition. But most musicians can't hear a single sound, they listen only to the relationship between 2 or more sounds. Music for them has nothing to do with their powers of audition, but only to do with their powers of observing relationships. In order to do this, they have to ignore all the crying babies, fire engines, telephone bells, coughs that happen to occur during their auditions. Actually, if you run into people who are really interested in hearing sounds, you're apt to find them fascinated by the quiet ones. Did you hear that? They will say. In 1954, when I went to Europe, I no sooner arrived in Paris than I noticed that the city was covered with posters publicizing a mushroom exhibition that was being held in the botanical gardens. That was all I needed. Off I went. When I arrived, I found myself in a large room filled with many tables upon which were displayed many species of fungi. On the hour, from a large centrally placed loudspeaker, a recorded lecture on the deadly poisonous amanitas was delivered. During this lecture, nobody in the hall moved or spoke. Each person's attention was, so to speak, riveted to the information being given. A week later, I was in Köln, in Germany, attending a concert of electronic music. There was also an audience and a large loudspeaker. However, many in the audience were dozing off, and some were talking to their neighbors. I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer whose works were being performed had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount."
But a lot of this music came along with an influx of Eastern ideas and a sort of westernized Buddhism. Lamont Young was a big composer and minimalist. He didn't use tape loops so much, but he was a minimalist composer, I think a precursor or an early drone musician. He very much thought of this as picking up on, I guess, a Buddhist idea of, seems meditative anyhow. Is that side of drone music still in the music today? Is that still a part of what this is about?
There's so much drone music today, and yes, there are lots of folks who come at it from kind of the Western New Age approach towards, you know, kind of boutique approach towards Eastern spirituality. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there are highs and lows associated with that. You know, I don't want to go so far as to, you know, repeat the criticism of Westerners who do yoga.
Right, right.
But it was an easy decision for a select group of people, like in the 60s, to start experimenting with drone music because they were in the, you know, kind of in a privileged position where you could pick and choose. You could decide to try to sound like Eastern or Indian music, all the while knowing you never go, you're not part of that. You don't actually have to go and live in misery in Calcutta. But drone has so much expanded since then. I mean, there's drone rock. There's kind of a more, like the work of Seller, one of the links I sent you, that he's an ambient artist who sometimes his music sounds like film soundtracks. Sometimes it sounds like Debussy and other classical composers. There's no particular Eastern mysticism in that type of music. And there's also the fact that drone now is really part and parcel of the film music vocabulary in Hollywood and elsewhere. So like everything else, there are niches and subgenres.
Note C. C. C.